This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, George Takei, became famous for his role as Mr. Sulu on Star Trek back in the 60s. But a lot of fans he's made in recent years admire him because of who he is, not just the roles he's played. That group of admirers will likely expand as a result of the new documentary about him called To Be Takei. His personal story offers insights into a couple of key chapters of American political and cultural history. After Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, he and his family were among the 127,000 Americans of Japanese descent who were forced into internment camps. As an adult, Takei became active in the civil rights and peace movements. But he couldn't support the movement that most directly affected him, the gay rights movement, because coming out could have ended his career. But when he did come out, in 2005, he became a forceful spokesperson for gay rights. The documentary To Be Takei is now on DirecTV and will be released in theaters August 22nd. He spoke with Terry last Monday.
George Takei, welcome to Fresh Air. So you seem so comfortable speaking about your life, and in the movie and in interviews, you're very open about your life. But when you were in the closet as a gay man, you couldn't be open. It would have probably ruined your career. You just couldn't take that risk. So, for instance, like when you were doing Star Trek, you've said that a lot of people on the show knew, but the public couldn't know. What was it like for you to have to keep such a fundamental part of who you are a secret when you seem so comfortable with yourself and so willing to share yourself now?
Well, the thing that affected me in the early part of my career was there was a very popular box office movie star, blonde, a good-looking, a good actor, named Tab Hunter. He was in almost every other movie that came out. And then one of the scandal sheets of that time exposed him as gay. And suddenly and abruptly, his career came to a stop. That was, to me, chilling and stunning. I was a young, no-name actor, and I knew that if it were known that I was gay, then there would be no point to my pursuing that career. So I chose to be in the closet. I lived a double life, and that means you always have your guard up, and it's a very, very difficult and challenging way to live a life.
But you were 68 by the time you came out, so much.
That's correct.
So much of your life had to be lived in the closet. That's a long time.
Yes, it was. And from the time I was a teenager, I learned that it was very important for us to be active participants in the democratic process. I grew up imprisoned in American barbed wire prison camps simply because Japanese Americans, American citizens of Japanese ancestry, happened to look like the people that bombed Pearl Harbor.
And this was in 1942, after FDR signed an executive order authorizing the military to set up these internment camps and bring people
to
them. So you spent how many years of your how old were you during the years that you were in the internment camp?
I had just turned 5, I think about 3 or 4 weeks after that, when the soldiers with bayoneted rifles came to our home in Los Angeles and ordered us out of our home. We were first taken to the horse stables of San Anita Racetrack because the camps weren't built yet, and we were housed there from a two-bedroom home into a narrow, smelly, it's still pungent with the smell of horse manure. And we were housed there for about 3 months while the camps were being built, and then put on railroad cars with armed guards at both ends of each car and transported 2/3 of the way across the country to the swamps of southeastern Arkansas. There were barbed wire fences there, tall sentry towers with machine guns pointed at us. When I made the night runs to the latrine, searchlights followed me. but, you know, to a 5-year-old kid.
To guard you, not to lead the way.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of nice that they lit the way for me to pee, but for my parents, of course, it was invasive, it was intimidating, it was embarrassing.
How did your parents explain it to you, explain why you were rounded up and put in an internment camp, living behind barbed wire?
Well, my father told us, my brother and me, he said that we're going for a long vacation to a place called Arkansas. Arkansas. I'd never heard that name. It sounded exotic to me. And so we were very excited about that. And, you know, children are amazingly adaptable. Given that preparation, it was like going camping. You know, we ate in a mess hall. We lined up 3 times a day. And when we bathed, we took mass showers. I went with my father to those showers. So my real memories of being imprisoned is, you know, catching pollywogs at the creek and putting them in a pickle jar and watching them sprout legs.
So you were basically imprisoned in internment camps set up by the U.S. government for Japanese Americans.
That's correct.
And you got in there when you were 5, got out when you were 9.
Not quite.
Not quite 9.
Yeah.
Okay. And in the new documentary, you say that about the time you were in 5th grade, maybe 6th grade, that you started realizing that you were attracted to boys.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking how traumatic that might have been, that realization, for somebody who'd already been so stigmatized because of World War II, because of the camps. And now you're realizing that you have the kind of feelings that mean you're going to be so marginalized. I mean, you must have had a sense of that.
Well, you wanted to be as, in quotes again, as normal as possible. And you strenuously make that effort. And you strenuously try to suppress what you feel, you know, when you see a good-looking guy with his shirt off. At school gyms, when you take a shower and there's a really good-looking guy, you know, and they're naked and they excite you, you try to control it. You're tempted to look at him, but at the same time, you force yourself to look away from him, you know. And it's that struggle that makes it so much more difficult. And then, as you grow a little bit older, you discover a place called a gay bar, where there are others that are like you, that gather together. And
thinking what it must have been like for you to go to gay bars when your face was known because of Star Trek. I mean, Star Trek.
That's right.
Star Trek became a bigger hit after it was canceled than it had been in its time.
That's right.
But still, I mean, a lot of people knew who you were. So you're in a gay bar trying to keep a low profile. It must have been
dangerous.
The thought must have entered your mind that somebody's going to recognize you and say, like, you'll never guess who's gay. You'll never guess who I saw at the bar. And that word would inadvertently get out.
And you have that fear, but you also are talking with other gays who also fear exposure. I mean, you could be a school teacher, and you could lose your job as a school teacher. You could be an insurance salesman, and your career would be over. Everybody in those gay bars were mindful of that. What it took was someone to have it out for you, someone who wants to get even with you on some score. And so I tried to avoid having enemies, have people being angry with me.
If you're just joining us, my guest is George Takei, who became famous as Mr. Sulu on Star Trek. And now there's a new documentary about him called To Be Takei. So maybe your fans know this better than I do, but I found out from your movie that you did some of the voices in Rodan, which was a monster movie I grew up with on television, a $1 million movie in New York where it was shown like all repeated every night for a week, several times a night, and then repeated all day and all night on the weekend. So growing up hearing the dubbed versions of Japanese monster movies, I started to think that there were two types of dubbed voices for men. One was a kind of high, hysterical voice, Godzilla's on the harbor, and then the kind of deep scientist voice, like, we must be cautious and take all steps to see what we can do. So, but you did like 6 or 7 voices in the movie.
I did.
So did you do like the high voice and the low voice?
I did both, yes. I can do a high-pitched voice, too. But I was the wise scientist with the horn-rimmed glasses. It was my first paying gig. I was an architecture student at Berkeley and back home for the summer. And it was my father who came across an ad looking for, this was in the Japanese American paper, and the ad was looking for what they called Japanese voices, whatever that might be, to dub in English dialogue onto this Japanese sci-fi movie. And my father said, well, you're a ham. Why don't you go and audition? You don't have a summer job. And so I did, and I got the job. And it was an exciting experience working with people like Key Luke and Bill Fries, grizzled veteran voice actors. And that was the experience that planted the idea of maybe I can be an actor. But what really kind of got me all warm and fuzzy inside was having Key Luke say to me, young man, you did a good day's job today.
So Key Luke was one of the actors or a director?
He was one of the actors. He was a Chinese-American actor who played number one son in the Charlie Chan series.
Oh,
and he was a veteran actor by that time.
Uh-huh.
He was a senior, and to get that kind of compliment from him was very, very flattering.
So when Star Trek was canceled and you were out of work, did you think, well, in the future, Star Trek is going to be so big, and then there's going to be like movies, Star Trek movies, it's going to go on and on and on, there's going to be Comic-Cons, I'm going to be like world famous for this. Did you have any sense of that?
Well, when we were filming the pilot for Star Trek back in 1965, I said to Jimmy Doohan, I smell quality with this series. Well, the scripts were intelligent, well-written scripts, and the actors were very fine, professional actors. And I told Jimmy, we're going to be proud of what we did, but this means we're in trouble, because all the TV series that I loved, all the ones that I thought had some substance, were immediately canceled. And I said, we won't last a season. Well, I was wrong on that. We lasted 3 seasons, but nevertheless, we were cast. So I had no idea that in reruns, we would finally find our audience and become an enormously popular, and indeed, now it's an iconic sci-fi series. So I was prescient in one sense, but certainly I didn't expect this kind of success for Star Trek.
I don't mean to pry into your financial holdings, but I'm wondering, like, did you have a good enough contract so when Star Trek became really super big that you got like good residuals?
I was a no-name actor, and we all signed the same contract. I don't know about Bill Shatner, but all the rest of us signed the standard contract on residuals. It paid residuals up to the 10th rerun. And we, you know, in those days, very few shows got beyond the 3rd or 4th, at most the 4th rerun. So we thought, you know, that's fine. And when it's after cancellation, when it was syndicated, it ran 5 nights a week in most of the markets, and the residuals were indeed handsome. But once it got to the 10th rerun, there was nothing. And so when you see reruns now, it's all profit for Paramount and the station running it.
Have there been other ways to profit from it?
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Yes,
the Star Trek conventions
right.
And the merchandising. I'm what my mother used to call a doll. She said people called you a doll when you were a little boy, and here you are an adult, and you're still a doll. I said, Mama, no, they're called action figures. And she insisted they're dolls.
You're both right. When did you come out to your parents?
My father passed before I came out to him. But, you know, deep down inside, I think he would have not been fazed by it. You know, he's a Japanese-American father of his generation, and he accepted his son pursuing a career as an actor. When I came back from Berkeley and said, I want to go to New York and study at the Actors Studio, he said, that's a fine, respected acting school. But they won't give you a diploma when you finish there. And your mother and I would like you to have that. But here in town in Los Angeles, we have UCLA, which has a fine theater arts department. And you can study acting and the theater there. And when you finish there, they will give you a diploma. So we will subsidize your studies there. But if you go to New York, be prepared to do it all on your own. So you choose.
So you think, had your father lived, that he would have been understanding?
That's right. You're
talking you were
about
gay.
Coming out to the family.
What about your mother? Did she?
My mother.
Did you come out to her?
By that time, I had a friend named Brad Altman, and
now your husband.
Now my husband. We were running mates. We met in a running club, and so when I came out to her, it was something that she had difficulty with, but she wasn't dealing with some unknown person or an idea. She knew Brad as my running buddy. And so I think putting a face on something that you're talking about makes it a little bit different. And she eventually came around to accepting who I am and certainly Brad.
So you and your partner then, husband now.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, agreed that the time was right to come out when you came out in, was it 9 years
well,
ago?
Well, the reason for that was
the
something extraordinary. Yes. California was the breakthrough state where marriage equality came through the legislature, both houses, and it went to the governor's desk. And Schwarzenegger vetoed it. And I was boiling about that, but I was still silent. But that night, Brad and I were watching the late night news, and we saw young people pouring out onto Santa Monica Boulevard, venting their rage against Arnold Schwarzenegger. And we felt just as angry as those young people. And we decided that I should speak out. And for me to do that, my voice had to be authentic, so I spoke to the press for the first time as a gay man.
How did it feel?
It was liberating. It was so freeing. But at the same time, I was prepared for my career to go on downhill side. But the polar opposite happened. It's blossomed, and I was invited to do guest appearances on various shows as gay George Takei, Will and Grace, or The Big Bang Theory. And I got the invitation from Howard Stern to be his official announcer, which Brad and I talked about, too. I've been on speaking tours advocating for equality for the LGBT community. But what we noticed was I was already talking to the converted, either LGBT people or allies. And what we needed to do was reach what I maintain is the decent, fair-minded, vast middle, people who are busy pursuing their lives and don't stop to think about other issues.
So one of the things you've become famous for, you know, in recent years is your appearances on Howard Stern and your role there as the announcer. And as you describe in the documentary about you, to be Takei, after your first appearance on the show, you didn't really want to go back because he's, you know, he asks about all kinds of body things that you are not comfortable talking about. So now that you're kind of, you know, a regular there, has your opinion about Howard Stern changed and the kinds of questions that he asks to people, including celebrities?
Howard is masterful at the interview, but Howard is deep down at the core a very decent guy and a humanitarian. People think that he's a raunchy, raucous guy, and he is that too. But he also makes commentaries on society and political issues, and he's got the guts to stand by them. Many public figures are reticent about taking strong positions. Howard does, and I have great respect for him, and he's very outspoken in a rational way that people can understand. And what he's done is given me access to that fair-minded, decent, wide middle of America. And I've gotten, as a result of being on this show, I've gotten letters, emails from people from really unexpected places. So he's been a real force in bringing America to the point where they embrace LGBT people as part of the diversity of America.
So he pranked you. Artie Lang.
He's very playful, yes.
Artie Lang made a fake confession to you that he was gay, and he asked for your guidance. And you, of course, didn't know that, A, this was a prank, and B, it was being recorded. And then you were confronted with that on one of Howard's shows. So how did you feel about that, and do you think that was a decent or a bad thing to do?
Well, I'm, first of all, a trusting guy. And Artie became a friend over the years that I did the show with him. And I respected his anxiety and his concern. He's a good actor, and I bought it. And I gave, you know, I'm a good guy, and I certainly am understanding of people who are closeted and try to help them. And I do feel suckered by that when it turned out to be a prank. But I should have known better, because Howard does that to me all the time.
And you didn't feel exploited by that?
No, because that's the nature of the show, you know. He had a fake Arnold Schwarzenegger engage me in debate on the show. And after he said that he was a Arnold Schwarzenegger imitator, I challenged him
This was via telephone?
Via telephone. I challenged him to get the real Arnold Schwarzenegger on. And a few days later, he had Arnold Schwarzenegger call in, and I launched into a debate with him, and it turned out to be the same fake calling me twice.
That's so funny.
Shame on me. Twice burned.
That's hysterical.
I'm a slow learner.
Well, George Takei, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
I've enjoyed our conversation.
George Takei speaking with Terry Gross last Monday. The new documentary about Takei, called To Be Takei, is now on DirecTV. It opens in theaters August 22nd. The new miniseries, The Honorable Woman, is about a woman who finds herself embroiled in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It premiered on the Sundance cable channel last Thursday and is a co-production between Sundance and England's BBC Two, where viewers have already seen about half the episodes. So have I. And while I expected The Honorable Woman to be topical and potentially controversial, given its setting and premise, I didn't expect it to be so involving or so intense. Or so good. The Honorable Woman is produced, written, and directed by Hugo Blick, who hasn't broken through in the States yet, but probably will now. TV viewers who were drawn to the political intrigues and moral complexities of Showtime's Homeland will be very, very pleased by the honorable woman. But so should viewers who revel in the unsettling surprises and shocking violence of HBO's Game of Thrones and AMC's The Walking Dead, because The Honorable Woman is one of the most ruthless TV dramas I've ever seen. Major characters in this miniseries not only die without warning, they die without foreshadowing and without dignity, like flies being swatted suddenly. Even before the opening credits roll, The Honorable Woman demonstrates this quickly and graphically. The very first scene is a flashback showing lunch at a fancy restaurant, where a young girl and boy fidget and joke with one another while their father tries to settle them down. The waiter who serves them dinner rolls with a pair of sharp tongs then uses the same tongs to stab their father in the throat. He dies as they watch in stunned disbelief, and as the little girl is dotted with his blood. Meanwhile, the adult voice of that girl is heard on the soundtrack, offering some perspective from the distant future. She's played by Maggie Gyllenhaal, who adopts a British accent and an understandably wary attitude to portray the grown-up Nessa Stein.
We all have secrets. We all tell lies just to keep them from each other and from ourselves. But sometimes, rarely, something can happen that leaves you no choice but to reveal it.
It's unusual and a little refreshing to see an American actress travel overseas to play someone with a British accent, given how many Brits are playing Americans on TV over here. But Gyllenhaal nails more than just the accent. She's playing a very complicated, hard-to-read character. A British baroness with an Israeli passport, an internet communications executive who has just been appointed a seat in the House of Lords, and a visionary who wants to donate money and resources to the West Bank. She thinks that improving conditions there and making the internet more available is the key to prospects for peace. But others disagree, sometimes very violently. The Honorable Woman includes killings and kidnappings, seductions and betrayals, and Ness's obsession about trust turns out to be very central to her character and to the drama itself. Every step Nessa takes or doesn't take is followed or influenced or thwarted by those around her. Especially her business partner brother Ephra, played by Andrew Buckman, and a British intelligence officer played by the always intriguing Stephen Ray. MI6, American spies, the Israelis, the Palestinians, they're all in play here, and they're not playing. Some of the power struggles are for money or territory. Others are sexual. There's a lot of tension between men and women here, corporate as well as cultural. And Gyllenhaal is fearless about exploring and portraying it all. Writer-director Blick peels back and reveals the elements of his story and the motivations and relationships of his characters very slowly. A scream you hear in episode 1 isn't explained until episode 4. And the pain behind anguished glances isn't evident until you've clocked hours of TV time. But by that time, The Honorable Woman has taken you places where TV seldom ventures. Not only to the tunnels under the Gaza Strip, and I couldn't believe I was seeing scenes set in those tunnels after they figured so prominently in the news, but to the deepest fears and hopes and dreams and despairs of the show's characters. Politically, The Honorable Woman doesn't take sides. It comes at you from all sides. And all sides are given motivations and conflicts, which makes this miniseries both a rare and a rewarding viewing experience. The characters in The Honorable Woman may not know whom to trust, but trust me, this is one TV drama not to miss. Prospect Hill, the new album by Dom Flemons, is his first since leaving the Carolina Chocolate Drops, a Grammy Award-winning group extending the tradition of African-American string bands of the 1920s and 30s. Flemons sings and also plays guitar, banjo, bones, harmonica, fife, and jug. His new solo album reflects his interest in old-timey music, blues, early jazz, and rhythm and blues. The album also includes a couple of original songs. Flemons grew up in Arizona and now lives in North Carolina. When he spoke with Terry last Wednesday, he brought several of his instruments to perform some songs for us.
Don Flemons, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me again, Terry.
So I want to start by asking you to play a song, and it's a song that's on your new album. The song is called My Money Never Runs Out. Tell us a little bit about the song before you play it.
Well, My Money Never Runs Out, it was originally recorded by a fellow by the name of Gus Cannon, who went by the name of Banjo Joe. He was a black banjo player and a songster, and he also was a fellow who performed in blackface. So he was a black fellow who played in blackface, and so he had a very unique repertoire that reflected the popular music of the 1890s and into the First World War.
Some people wouldn't touch music that had anything to do with blackface.
Well, you know, Gus Cannon's music is very interesting in the way that he was part of that generation that retained a lot of the same repertoire, but they took out words like coon and of course the N-word and darkie, and they took all those particular words out of the songs, even though they retained the musical material. So Gus Cannon was part of that, and he was kind of like the lower rungs of the music industry compared to people like Burt Williams, who were on the top rungs.
So do the song for us. It's called My Money Never Runs Out. Oh, well, after it's over, I'll ask you to tell us about the banjo you're playing.
Oh, sure thing.
Okay.
All right. Here's a little of My Money Never Runs Out.
Okay. Now there's a flirting yellow joker living round this town. He's just as lazy as a lazy cane be. Now as long as they flirt, boys, he hangs around. I love my hops, is he. Early one morning, his joker ran away to roam the world, was said. I believe I'll go back to bed, man, I give up my head. I don't care if I never wake up. Yes, I don't care if I never wake up till the birds is through with me. Now I'm coming around here with my big fold. I'm gonna run 'em up a tree. Nothing like a living like a money, a king. Drink from a silver cup. I eat pork and pears. I eat out of my class. I don't care if I never wake up. Yes, yes. Boys was stacked high. I believe my soul would touch the sky. I polish people in the diamond dust, man. I don't care with this banjo bass, cause my money don't never run out. You rich fools, you are making me shout. Every good evening, this sweet old toast I shout. Yes, I'm a living a good all the time. Don't drink no beer and no cheap wine, and I always flate, cause my money don't never run out.
And that's Don Flemons performing in our studio, and he does that song and his new album, which is called Prospect Hill. It is so much fun to hear that, and so educational to hear it too. So I'm going to ask you to pick the banjo back up and tell us about it. And was the style that you were playing a style that Gus Cannon originated?
Well, this style I was playing in is my own adaptation of Gus Cannon's style. He played with a five-string banjo. And when I started playing, I started with four strings. I had a good friend of mine who passed me a five-string banjo that he'd taken the fifth string out of. So I learned how to play all the songs I knew on guitar on the banjo. So, you know, I used to play songs like this, like a song like Me and Julio Down by the Schoolyard by Paul Simon. So, you know, I'd do it more frantic in like a...
Well, mama pajama rolled out of bed and she went to the police station. Pop found out and she began to shout and start the investigation. Was against the law, was against the law. What the mama saw was against the law. Ooh, well, mama turned around and spit on the ground every time my name gets mentioned. Papa said, oh, if I get that boy, I'm gonna stick him in the house detention. Well, I'm on my way. I don't know where I'm going, I'm on my way. I'm taking my time, but I don't know where. Goodbye to Rosie, the queen of Corona. Seeing me and Julio down by the schoolyard. Seeing me and Julio down by the schoolyard.
That's really great. That's so much fun. So that's how you learn to play banjo, by adapting like rock songs and stuff like that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I used to just take all sorts of different stuff, and I'd experiment on the banjo or the guitar, and then I found out about open D tuning, open G tuning on the guitar, and I found that I could take different techniques I learned on the banjo, put them on the guitar, and then I worked them the other way around, putting stuff on the guitar onto the banjo. And that gave me my own sort of way of looking at the material, so when I got into old-timey music, a lot of the stuff is based on that, those same sort of notes and chord shapes and stuff like that, so I began to form my own style based on that.
I was wondering if I could ask you to perform an excerpt of one of the songs that first got you interested, either in folk music or in music of the 20s and 30s.
Well, one of the things that really got me interested in a lot of the old music was a documentary called The History of Rock and Roll, and they had an episode about the folk revival.
Was this the PBS series?
Yes, it was. Mm-hmm. When I was watching that documentary, one of the first country blues musicians I got interested, they had a little clip of him, and it was Lightning Hopkins doing the song Mojo Hand, and I just loved the sound of it. It was, I'm going to Louisiana, I'm going to give him Mojo Hand. I'm going to Louisiana, I'm going to give me a mojo hand. I'm going to fix my woman's soul, she can't have no other man. That's what I'm going to do.
So, you know, I can hear that you can, you're almost trying to channel the performers that you do and get their voice as well as their guitar style down. I guess if you have a really good ear, it's easier to do that, to really also copy somebody's voice. You were telling me earlier, before we started the broadcast, that when you were performing solo early in your career, you would do imitations performers.
Yeah. The idea that I had in my 16-year-old mind is that, see, I'd hear these songs and no one else knew what these songs were, so I tried my best to replicate them so that people would get a sense of the song as it was performed by the original performer. At that time, I didn't feel like I had any interesting stories. After being in the business now for 15 years just about now, I have some stories of my own, but at first I didn't really have stories, so I would tell other people's stories, and then, you know, I'd do like I'll do a funny one of I used to do Nashville Skyline Bob Dylan. I used to do you know, most people know him as with this voice. Go away from my window, leave at your own chosen speed. You know, but in Nashville Skyline, he started singing like,
Piggy D stole my poor heart away. By golly, what more can I say? Love to spend the night with Piggy D.
I used to do that. When I was 18, I got to see Dave Van Ronk, and I heard him do this song. And especially with Llewyn Davis coming out, now people know a little bit more about Dave Van Ronk, which is really beautiful to me.
Well, listen here, pretty papa, please get out of my sight. I'm calling it quits now, right from this very night. You've had your day. Don't stand around. You've been a good old wagon daddy, but you done broke down.
But you were telling me that you also did Van Morrison.
Let's see.
Half a mile from the county fair, and the rain came pouring down. Me and Bully standing there with a silver half a crown. Heads are full of fishing rod and a tackle on her back. Oh, we just stood there getting wet with our backs against the fence.
And if I want to sing it like Van Morrison now.
Oh, and the water, oh, the water, la 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 la.
You know, and I do things like that, or, you know.
One of the instruments you brought with you today is the largest banjo I've ever seen. I think there probably aren't many like this in the world. Does it have a name?
Well, you know, I just realized I'm going to start calling it Big Head Joe. Because someone was sitting in an audience at a show and they just kept saying, "That's such a big head on that banjo." And I've been trying to think of a name, so Big Head Joe, I think, is going
to
be.
That's very good. Would you describe its size and how it compares to a regular banjo?
Well, it's an 18-inch head on here, and usually most banjos you see are maybe 11-inch heads in diameter. It has a very fancy pick guard, a very extravagant inlay, because this was actually made in Philadelphia. There was a small guitar-making studio that made this banjo. It's called the Clef Club brand banjo. I picked it up at the Retrofret guitar shop in Brooklyn, and they couldn't find anything to specifically link the Clef Club brand with the Clef Club Orchestra, which was James Reese Europe's orchestra. But, you know, I'm taking a little bit of historical liberty by saying if there's the Clef Club brand of banjo, and this is a big banjo like you'd have in a banjo orchestra, I feel like it's at least a knockoff that a professional musician had made for him, because it has a really fancy pick guard. It has a little holder for your flat pick. It came with a capo. It had lights that you could clip onto the truss rod so that you can heat the head of the banjo in case it happens to be a hot day and the skin gets moist. You know, it has this little custom lights so you can just plug them in
like
there.
Like to dry it out?
Yeah, just to dry it out so that it can, you know, because if, see right now, there's not too much humidity, but if there was more of it, the skin would start to sink down and the notes would start to sound kind of mushy.
So when was this first made?
This was made in, they have it written down as circa 1924. And so this is an old vintage instrument here that is just one of a kind. And I'm really glad to be the owner of it.
And it's much deeper sounding than a regular banjo.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, for example here, a song that I've played for quite a few years is "Your Baby Ain't Sweet Like Mine," which is a Papa Charlie Jackson number. But on this banjo, it sounds, this is a little bit more how Papa Charlie played it, and I'll sing it more like Papa Charlie too.
I'm gonna tell you about my baby, but I can't tell you everything about my baby. It'll be possible to tell you everything. It wouldn't be possible to tell you everything. Everybody talking about the sweetie nowadays. I got the one with the sweetest ways. Your baby may roll a jelly fine. Nobody baby can roll it like mine. Your baby ain't sweet like mine. She bake a jelly roll all the time. And when I'm feeling lonesome and blue, my baby know just what to do. Yes, sir, she even calls me honey. She even let me spend her money. Never has a baby put me out though. She even buys me all my clothes. I don't want to brag, I want to put you in line. Your baby ain't sweet like mine, oh no. Your baby ain't sweet like mine.
Oh, that's great.
And so just for comparison's sake, I'll play it on the regular guitar. I'll play the same thing.
Let's see here.
Even between guitar, banjo.
Everybody talking about the sweetie nowadays. I got the one with the sweetest way.
See, it even has a completely different tone if I just played on this regular guitar. And that's always been the appeal of those instruments, is that it's tuned like a guitar. And it plays like a guitar, but it has a banjo quality to it.
So there's a song that you do on your new album. It's called "But They Got It Fixed Right On," that I'd like you to do for us. And you do that on that really large banjo.
Oh, yes. Yeah, see, now, because a song like "But They Got It Fixed Right On" is so ridiculous that I have to have this ridiculous banjo to go with it.
Tell us about the song before you play it.
Now, the song is a type of song called a hokum song, which is like a song. The hokum songs are humor songs that are, they have double entendres, so they mean different, you know, two different things at one time when you say a certain phrase. And this was actually recorded and written by Thomas A. Dorsey and Tampa Red. And this was the type of music that Thomas A. Dorsey was doing before He had actually a series of tragedies which led him to become a very, very much a God-fearing man. And he then wrote Precious Lord, Take My Hand and Peace in the Valley. And he actually made a larger career being a gospel songwriter. But beforehand, he and Tampa Red came up with the song Honey, It's Tight Like That. And a lot of these hokum numbers, he pretty much invented the style. And so I'll play it for you now. But they got it fixed right on.
With a Ford and a boy named Jim. He liked her and she liked him. Both broke down in a country bar, but they didn't get home until after dark. But they got it fixed, ain't no doubt. Nobody know what the song's about. Too bad that the news got out, but they got it fixed right on. A man with a peg leg and a gal named Sue broke his peg leg half in two. Only way that they could fix the leg was to get this gal to take a hold of the peg. But they got it fixed, ain't no doubt. Nobody know what the song's about. Too bad that the news got out, but they got it fixed right on. A gal walked into the butcher shop, grabbed the butcher's big ham hock. Butcher knocked her right off her feet. She missed his bone, but she got his meat. But they got it fixed, ain't no doubt. Nobody know what the song's about. Too bad that the news got out, but they got it fixed right on. Now there, Monkey and the Polecat made a deal to discuss the subject of sex appeal. Skunk won the argument right or wrong, cause his sex appeal was much too strong. But they got it fixed, ain't no doubt. Nobody know what the song's about. Too bad that the news got out, but they got it fixed right on.
That's great. Well, Don Flemons, it's really been great to talk with you and to hear you perform. Thank you so much for being with us and for playing for us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Terry. And I just have to say that it's just such a great pleasure to be here again on the show with you.
Dom Flemons spoke with Terry last Wednesday. His new album is called Prospect Hill. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sharrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.B. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Inkulik.